U.S. Offshore Wind Supporters Map Path Forward, written by John Crop Lee, and read by an automated voice. New York. After a remarkably bad year for the U.S. offshore wind industry, the Oceanic Network's annual conference was focused on engineering a rebound rather than licking the wounds. The official theme of IPF 2026 was Reimagine, Renew, Reignite, and most speakers emphasized one or more of those. But there was another recurring message: renewal and reignition are on hold until January 20, 2029, when a president more supportive of generating electricity with wind turbines at sea might be inaugurated. The important thing, speakers said, is that the reimagining not wait until then. U.S. offshore wind was struggling well before Donald Trump was elected president again, and if the second act is to be more successful than the first, changes need to be considered. It was a very bad year. This year's International Partnering Forum was much smaller than previous editions, for obvious reasons. The active components of the U.S. offshore wind portfolio are 5 facilities under construction totaling 5.8 gigawatts and a completed 132 megawatts facility. Stalled, shelved, and canceled plans are much greater in number and proposed capacity. Fewer than 900 people attended IPF 2026, compared with more than 1,500 at the 2025 edition and more than 3,000 in 2024, when 30 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2030 still was the official goal of the Biden administration. But the Midtown Manhattan ballroom that served as the main venue for IPF 2026 was packed. The few empty seats went unfilled only because the people standing in the rear of the room were too circumspect to wait in once the program started. A metaphorical elephant also was in the room, and Oceantic President Liz Burdock pointed it out immediately in her opening address February 10. Since January 2025, offshore wind has faced a series of coordinated administrative actions, legal challenges, and political attacks unlike anything we have ever seen. We wake up day after day to another headline that questions whether this industry has a future in the United States, and that's exactly why being here together matters. With the elephant acknowledged, she and subsequent speakers reminded listeners what they have accomplished and exhorted them to keep alive the vision behind their earlier efforts: clean, fixed-price power from an abundant source. What is left of the U.S. offshore wind sector has pushed back against the Trump administration's attacks and continued to make progress in the 10 months since IPF 2025. It also has generated some operational data. The Long Island Power Authority's South Fork Wind, the first utility-scale facility in U.S. waters, began commercial operation nearly 2 years ago, and its performance counters the criticism of offshore wind as unreliable. It generated power in 90% of the hours and on 362 of the days in 2025, ending the year with a capacity factor of 46.3%. That is remarkable production from a wind turbine site, said Mikkel Malesen, head of U.S. offshore generation at Ørsted, developer and now operator of South Fork. Vineyard Wind, which is nearing completion off the Massachusetts coast, showed its value by sending up to 600 megawatts to the strained New England grid during the winter storm of January 2026, Burdock noted, when the storm hit, offshore wind showed up. New York was the host of IPF 2026 and by some measures is the center of the U.S. offshore wind sector. It has contracted for power from 3 separate wind facilities. No other state has more than one contract. New York also has had more problems with its offshore wind program than any other state, including multiple contract cancellations and repeated cost escalations. However, New York continues to press forward in 2026. Its portfolio is smaller than in 2023 and will cost ratepayers more, but it has steel in the water, some of it operational and the rest making progress toward operation. Keynote speaker Doreen Harris, president of the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority, or NYSERDA, said offshore wind remains an important part of the state's future energy strategy, despite the setbacks and roadblocks in its path. It's been a year that we couldn't have anticipated, but that is why we plan for uncertainty, and collectively, we have demonstrated the durability of our commitment, not just today, not just tomorrow, but into the coming years, as we really see the benefits of these projects move forward. The Empire Wind and Sunrise Wind projects are contracted to deliver 810 and 924 megawatts to New York once operational. The Trump administration has halted work on Sunrise once and Empire twice. The developers won injunctions and resumed work, but the administration has said it will appeal.
If these two facilities can reach commercial operation, they and South Fork can be a model for the ecosystem once and still envisioned for the U.S. offshore wind sector, with overlapping benefits such as job creation, industrial development, infrastructure upgrades, and new carbon-free electricity for a region of the New York ISO grid that is sliding toward reliability violations.
We will learn not only their operating characteristics, we will learn more about the impacts that they are or aren't having, Harris said. Ultimately, we will be able to demonstrate that offshore wind can and will be delivered in a durable, responsible, and cost-effective manner for New Yorkers and, frankly, for the entire U.S. What went wrong? Multiple challenges faced the offshore wind sector as it attempted to establish itself and develop momentum in the United States. Understanding what went wrong is key to moving forward. Burdock led a panel discussion on this theme. We can't keep importing models that don't quite fit, she said, referring to the large and long-running European offshore wind sector, and panelists agreed. Georgia Sassi and Nicerta, Senior Vice President of Large-Scale Resources Copyright RTO Insider. Even so, there have been valuable takeaways from Europe. Many of the early U.S. offshore projects contracted their income long before they contracted their expenses and had to cancel the contracts when inflation set in. The contract for difference model used in European offshore wind projects made an allowance for this, and New York successfully adapted it for its later contracts, said Georgia Sassi Nicerta, Senior Vice President of Large-Scale Resources. But he said a wholesale adaptation of European practices is unworkable in the U.S. There are many more regulatory layers here. When things are going well, it's easy to ignore risk, and offshore wind has a lot of risk, said Will Hazlett, President of National Grid Ventures. And unfortunately, over the course of the last 3-4 years, we've seen all those risks emerge, and it's highlighted that some of the frameworks we had in place weren't fit to manage all those risks. Billy Hoglund, Hoglund Group CEO Copyright RTO Insider. Billy Hoglund, CEO of the Hoglund Group, reminded listeners that the global pandemic with its resulting supply chain disruptions and price increases played a significant role in U.S. offshore wind's problems. But a too slow adaptation to those factors damaged the sector and left it less able to fight back when Trump set out to squash it. Sassine pointed to offshore transmission development as a challenge, but he framed these things as growing pains, rather than failure and errors. When we were launching a new industry, it required a very different approach than where we are today, with a more mature industry, he said. Now that we have a few projects and more developing, we just have the natural evolution of this industry, where we need to adapt. Kent Herzog, Burns & McDonnell Senior Managing Director Copyright RTO Insider. Burdock wondered if the industry and policymakers had erred by framing offshore wind as generation rather than energy infrastructure. No one protested the idea. Kent Herzog, Senior Managing Director at Burns & McDonnell, later drilled down on this theme. We treated offshore wind like a transaction, he said, and I'm here to argue that it's more about infrastructure, which I think you really heard several times this morning. When you try to build infrastructure using transactional tools, procurement models, risk allocation, timelines that assume certainty, you shouldn't be surprised when those systems break. Amanda Lefton, New York State Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner, Copyright RTO Insider. The California High-Speed Rail Project, Boston's Big Dig, and the U.S. Interstate Highway System saw similar system-level problems in their execution, Herzog said. Politics, COVID, supply chains, all those things had impacts on this industry, no question, but they did not cause these problems. In my opinion, they exposed it. Because the systems we built were already fragile. It just hadn't been stress-tested yet. He continued, we wanted offshore wind, but we also wanted low prices, minimum risk exposure, rapid timelines, and one-off procurements that didn't require long-term coordination. Those demands are not irrational, they're very understandable, but taken together, they weren't achievable, not for a first-of-its-kind industrial system. Herzog concluded, President Trump didn't kill offshore wind. We did, by building a fragile system and hoping politics wouldn't test it. Moving forward. Most speakers February 10 struck a more upbeat tone than Herzog, as might be expected when urging an audience to retain its professional, financial and personal commitments to a diminished enterprise that the President of the United States is trying to derail. Burdock said new reality facing the industry in the past year gives us a freedom and an obligation to design a new model for offshore wind in the United States, reimagine, renew and reignite. That is exactly what this moment demands of us. Harris said, we know that the market has been tested in ways that we could not have anticipated in just 1 year. These challenges are real, and they are not unique to New York, but what does matter is how we respond to them. Katie Dykes, Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection Commissioner, Copyright RTO Insider. Sassine said New York is focusing on preservation and then adaptation, protecting the existing projects, getting them built and keeping the industry intact through its struggles. Looking forward, this is an opportunity for us to pause and rethink and adapt and evolve our model going forward. New York State Commissioner of Environmental Conservation Amanda Lefton, a former director of the U.S. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, said recent experiences highlight the importance of meticulous permitting. All five projects under construction in U.S. waters had defensible permits and were able to secure injunctions against the Trump administration's December stop work orders. Strong regulatory structures can be seen as anti-business, she conceded, but in this situation, they have helped the industry. Katie Dykes, Commissioner of Connecticut's Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, reminded the audience who will foot the cost of offshore wind projects, which have grown sharply more expensive in the 2020s. Other types of resources are facing similar price pressures, she said. But that does not mean that our state, at least, is going to purchase offshore wind at any cost. Catherine Perry, New Jersey Board of Public Utilities Deputy Director of Resource Adequacy Copyright RTO Insider. Catherine Perry, Deputy Director of Resource Adequacy for the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities, said her state's first swing at offshore wind cost it some credibility with a key constituency. In New Jersey, we have lost some public confidence in the industry. We've talked a lot about investor confidence, but without public confidence, you don't have the political support to continue solicitations and bring projects forward. One of the things we need to work on as an industry in the state of New Jersey moving forward is rebuilding the public trust, rebuilding momentum for the industry, she added. It's a little bit of a call to action here. We can't do it alone as the state regulator, and we are going to need support. Burdock said circumstances present a window for improvement. It isn't often that you get an opportunity to recreate something better, more durable than the first time around, she said. So I view this as a good time for the offshore wind industry, despite all the challenges that we've had during the last year.